Hello and welcome to the Club Chimera Martial Arts Podcast. My name is Jamie Club and my intention with these shows is to discuss various issues in the world of martial arts and self-protection that have inspired my teaching, training and writing. If you're interested in the material I cover, please check out the show notes at the end of this program and also my website, clubchimera.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this show for archive episodes and to be notified about future content. And I'd be very grateful if you shared the show with your friends via social media. On the subject of social media, please check out our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and LinkedIn pages, as well as our YouTube channel. With housekeeping out of the way, let us proceed to the main feature, the final part of this year's mini-series of shows on martial arts fictional media. Put down the gloves and pick up the popcorn for Tales of Martial Movie Massacre. The Sound of One-Fist Punching by Jan Drachman.
Welcome, Jan Drachman, to my show. It's lovely to see you again, Jan. We're doing this via Skype, so it'll be interesting to see how it comes out. And Jan's got a couple of things that I really admire in a martial artist. One is that he's obviously a progressive martial artist, runs Hinrup Karate. I've been and trained over in Denmark with Jan on two separate occasions, 2019 and 2013. But also, Jan is a man of science as well, so that's always very good to be on our show. But there's another thing, of course, that's very important about Jan, and that is that he's a fan of martial arts movies too. So he's a progressive martial artist with a pragmatic view, a man of science, but also is a big fan of the movies. So take it away, Jan. I think your first point is on martial arts sound effects and your opinion on martial arts sound effects and how they can ruin good martial arts movies.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I really enjoy your podcasts, all of them, not just the one on martial arts movies. And as you told me, said before, I have always admired martial arts movies. When Bruce Lee came out and all the Hong Kong movies came to Denmark, I'm from Denmark, if you didn't recognize my accent. So then I was keen of watching all the martial arts movies coming to Denmark. And the funny thing was that they was all made in Hong Kong, the first ones. From the Shaw Brothers, King Boxer, and On the Way Forward. But here in Denmark, they was not called Kung Fu movies, they were called Karate movies, because no one knew Kung Fu at the time. Karate was the most popular martial art in the 70s in Denmark. So I actually started watching karate films instead of kung fu movies. But nowadays, it's more or less all kind of action films that includes a nice fight. And that's what we loved about the martial arts movies early on. They introduced the elaborate fight scenes where it was the most important part of the action. There was the fights that drove most of the story. And nowadays, if you watch films like, especially John Wick 1, 2 and 3, there is awesome fight scenes, and I have always enjoyed a good fight. When you see the early sound design, because one thing I don't like about any fight scene is that when the sound design is not well done. In the early Kung Fu movies in the 70s, it was obvious that it was bad sound design. It was like all these whooshes and wee, whoosah, and it was not that good. And nowadays, some people are still trying to do by coincidence, doing quite poor sound design. And one thing is, for instance, if you have a different sound for, if you don't do different sound for different impacts, if I hit you in the face, Jamie, it sounds different than if I punch you in the stomach. When you're in the business, you know how it sounds.
Yes.
And sometimes you see people, they maybe have the limited They don't think about the importance of good sound design. So you just hear, they can use the same sound, that you can recognize it again and again in the same fight. You can hear the same. You start thinking about it, really annoying. It really annoys me with poor sound design. If there's too much sound, too much whooshes, and the impact is more or less identical with all the attacks, I think it's...
And we often look at the earlier Kung Fu Karate movies, certainly in the 70s, with awe, because we used to think they had really, really good fight choreography. And a lot of them did have better, more sophisticated fight choreography than what we were seeing over in the UK and the US and in Europe. But a lot of them, they were using sound effects to cover up, I often used to find that if you muted the sound and you actually looked at the fight choreography, you were going, actually, this fight scene is not it's being used to cover it up. And I have remembered seeing a few films where it becomes very obvious, and two sides of it. It can either be used to sort of cover up poor fight choreography, and then that starts becoming quite obvious, especially if it's really bad sound effects, and that really then ends up drawing your attention to how bad the fight choreography is. Or it can be really good fight choreography, but the sound effects just completely takes you out of it. The Simpsons cartoon series is often credited with being one of the first animated shows. I'm sure it probably wasn't. I'm sure they were doing it in other parts of the world, but certainly in the US, is the first comedy cartoon series that you started using realistic sound effects when people were getting injured or bumped and stuff like that. And it was when Homer Simpson falls down a cliff, you think he tries to do it with a skateboard, doesn't he, in an episode, but he's trying to stop Bart from going across this canyon with a skateboard, and he has to end up doing it to stop his son from doing it. And there's a particular scene there where you hear these sound effects, and they probably aren't realistic sound effects, but they're what the audience expect to hear when somebody hits things. And it was comedy, but it made everyone cringe because they weren't hearing the normal doink sort of Tom and Jerry bash sort of thing going. Yeah, so it changes everything.
If you're not aware of it and you're watching a movie, a lot of things going on in the sound design. Many people don't recognize it, but all the feeling you get in the stomach when you're watching a movie is more or less sound.
Yes.
For instance, if you do a good hit, if I swing a haymaker to your face, and then the impact is one thing and the whoosh is another thing, but then there's these hits and that's afterwards.
Definitely.
The sound design of a good punch and a good kick is layered with at least 3 or 4 levels of sound. Maybe there's maybe 2 impacts. Mm-hmm. Different impacts on top of each other. Then there is the small whoosh when it comes, and then there is the hit or some woo. I can try to play some. You can hear poor sound design. I'll just play now a poor sound design where you just have a single sound like we talked about earlier, just like, and then a better designed one. We can see if you can hear a difference. Then we can hear that the good sound design is maybe not as obvious in these speakers. So when you hear that, because most people are listening to podcasts at their iPhone or in the car or something. But if you see it in the IMAX in a big studio, that's what makes the good sound design. This is all the extra layers of sound that you can hear. And it really improves the fight. And if you have done one where you try to swing it right to the face of a guy and you know he's not injured, but all this sounding... It feels nice. It feels just nice. It's a big difference.
It changes a lot. Far more that you can do, obviously, as a sound designer. But I think a lot of that definitely comes back to the live performance when you do stage fighting. And you look at everything from pro wrestlers' chops across the chest. And that they do those movements on purpose because they give the audience that reward for impact.
Yeah.
This is what they're looking for the drama. That's why, again, stage fighting, actors are taught how to make their own sound effects. When it gets projected via different mediums, such as your television or cinema or things like that, you can then have a far more sophisticated sound design.
Yeah.
And you describe that as sort of feeling that you get in your gut almost, and you don't realize that it's actually coming from the sound design. And I remember... I mean, it's a very derided horror movie now. Game adaptation. But the first Resident Evil does get one thing right, and that is the sound design. And the artist, Marilyn Manson, who did all the music for it, he said that he did exactly what you were describing there with the music. And that's what helped create that sense of dread that was coming up. So although that film is now taken apart and there's a lot of things that people don't like about it, the acting, the scripting, pretty much everything. But in terms of the sound design, it works very, very well. I remember feeling this at the time when I watched it in the cinema, completely raw, didn't really know what to expect other than I'd played the game a couple of times with a friend of mine. That was about it. And we were impacted by very much that sound. And then later on, I heard listened to an interview with Marilyn Manson where he was talking about how he really worked on putting that into the elements of the music. So you felt that dread when something was coming. And it's interesting how you're talking about how that then can be conveyed through a sound effect. So like a fight scene.
Exactly.
It doesn't have to necessarily be realistic. When you see footage of people firing a gun, like a proper machine gun in a war zone situation, it very rarely sounds like what a gun sounds like in a movie, in an action movie, because you're not after realism, but more it's what the audience are expecting to be realistic.
Yeah.
It's own drama, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just like when you do a good fight scene and you hit people. Normally, if you hit people in the stomach, or they just collapse into place, they won't fall 2 meters away or something, but you expect them to fly away in there. And same with the sound design.
Yeah.
When you hit people for real, it sounds different.
Yeah, exactly. A lay audience, I mean, maybe you and I, when we're getting engaged watching a combat sport or something, and one that we completely understand and we've trained a lot in and had experience in, we can empathize a lot with the two fighters. But the general lay audience aren't necessarily going to do that. They're not particularly into that sport or they haven't had an experience of it. But when they watch it being dramatized, they want to be able to empathize with the fighters. They want to be able to feel what's going on with the fighters. And they do that by the exaggeration and how that is done through sound design as much as the visuals. Yes.
Yeah. And the funny observation is actually when you see the UFC fights now going on right now because of the corona lockdown. Yeah.
Yes.
There's no audience.
No.
So you can hear the sounds when they hit each other.
Yeah.
The fight is actually much better.
Yeah, exactly. You're actually getting a more realistic view of it, aren't you? Yeah, exactly.
They're more intense because when they get hit, they're not disguised by all the audience and the shouting, but you can hear them when they.
Yeah.
It's more or less like a fight we've seen in the movie, more or less.
Yes, it actually is getting closer to it in a way, yes, in respect. So, yeah, even though I'm saying that, obviously they're exaggerated on film and it's not exactly as it really would feel. But now you're actually seeing it without the dampening of the audience and you are beginning to get a more up close feel of what a real fight's like.
Broken Glass by Gretchen Carlson.
Hi everybody, Gretchen Carlson here to ruin your perfectly good action scenes with physics. It turns out some things should just not be punched, and glass is one of them. Under the right circumstances, glass isn't that hard to break. Punching a normal window, for example, a committed blow should get the job done. But if you think about what happens in slow motion, your knuckles hit the window pane first and apply more pressure in a small area than the glass can withstand, so it breaks. But it doesn't break cleanly. There'll be sharp edges that haven't broken off, or haven't broken off yet. Old man Google tells me that those shards can be sharper than a scalpel, but take that for what it's worth. Those pieces don't need to be very sharp at all for a full force punch to drive them deep into your arm. If you're lucky, it'll just bleed. If you're not lucky, you can cut tendons, nerves, arteries, and you could permanently damage your hand. And as you might imagine, getting thrown out of a window is also pretty bad. But that would make the sequel pretty boring. Following a washed-up action hero who got out of the world-saving business because he only has the use of one hand? In the second act, he unscrews a jar, and it's a huge accomplishment for him. So movie physics can't really work that way. I really like how that got called out in Last Action Hero. In the movie, Jack Slater is played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he's whisked out of the movie world and into the real world. And at one point, he punches a car window, and he's surprised that it hurts. And Danny, his young fan, explains that things don't work that way in the real world. You can't smash a car window with your bare hands and have it not hurt. But auto glass is a lot more durable than glass from the window in a house. Because auto glass is different. Laminated glass is glass on either side of PVB plastic and then bonded together. This accomplishes two things. Number one, since the glass sticks to the plastic, if it breaks, it's less likely to go flying everywhere, which is especially important at, say, freeway speeds. And number two, it makes the glass much harder to break. I don't want to say impossible, but I will say that a cursory YouTube search showed me a whole bunch of videos where people gave up on the punching and resorted to breaking car windows with other things. And that's probably for the best, since not all of them were wearing protective coverings on their hands and arms. But actors break windows with their bare hands, and it's actually pretty cool how they do it. Basically, it's not real glass. They use a fake window that's made to look like real glass. It's usually plastic or sugar. In fact, if you wanted to, you could make sugar glass at home and record your own amateur fight scene, and then eat your prop when you're done. So yeah, when Crushy McKnuckles punches a window with his bare hand, he's really demonstrating that he's not the sharpest cookie in the sea.
Few fictional mediums address the reality of punching hard, solid surfaces with a collection of 27 small bones that make up a fist. Therefore, it's not surprising that we see actors portraying normal human beings punching holes through all sorts of surfaces and regularly slamming their knuckles into the jawbones of other characters with no apparent damage done to their hands. In the 1984 science fiction horror, and I contest that it is a horror, The Terminator, the film's hero, Sarah Connor, played by the brilliant Linda Hamilton, has it rationalised to her that her pursuer, the titular Terminator, was probably on PCP when it smashed its fist through glass. The film was acknowledging its incredible premise that performing such a feat was out of the ordinary for a regular human being. Bringing matters back down to earth, Shane Meadows' This Is England franchise works remarkably well in conveying realistic drama, and this includes its depictions of violence. In the first episode of This Is England 90, the character Sean starts a fight by punching the new boyfriend of his ex-girlfriend and immediately recoils in pain, nursing his hand. One of my lasting memories of watching the Fall Guy reruns was the image in the opening credits of Lee Majors playing stuntman and bounty hunter Colt Seavers shaking his hand in agony after punching someone. The scene clearly is intended to demonstrate the separation between the staged fights in Seavers' stuntman career and the realities of violence he encounters when moonlighting as a bounty hunter. It was a real honour for me that Gretchen Carlson agreed to return for this year's show after her very popular contribution last year. I'm sure you'll agree the sequel was well worth the wait. Her Martial Journeys in Madison County is one of the best martial arts podcasts you can download. It's one of the podcasts that's an immediate must-listen for me once it appears on my newsfeed. She's another progressive martial artist with a scientific mind and another critical thinker in the pursuit of truth. Her website is martialjourneysofmadison.com, serving as the digital shopfront of her own youth and adult classes, as well as a blog on her travels and martial arts insights. Ninja Homeopathy by Jamie Club. Beginning in Japan's Edo period, the Shinobi no Mono, in modern times referred to as ninja, were transformed into a fictional martial arts super agent. The literature and drama over the next three centuries little resembled what the historical researchers of today tell us about the historical shinobis. Real ninjas were individuals trained for a specific job within the samurai war machine. There was no ninja counterculture. But there were samurai, in certain regions, who trained soldiers in ninjutsu. This might be compared to certain modern soldiers being trained as snipers. Ninja came from various different ranks and were employed mainly for infiltration, intelligence and sabotage work. Primary source evidence reveals no specific ninja weaponry or even specialised weapon training, no specific art of unarmed combat and no specific uniform. They were soldiers with a unique and specialised job in the same way as others were musketeers, pikemen, drummers, bell ringers, archers, tacticians, chefs and accountants. Nevertheless, the legend has grown into what Japanese historian Stephen Turnbull calls an invented tradition. The ninja in popular fiction is a masked, shadowy assassin, an elite warrior whose fighting skills seem almost or literally supernatural. They are superheroes or villains. However, just as certain characters might be described to have plot armour when lazy writing glaringly shows their survival to be down to the demands of a story, so the ninjas have their own reverse plot armour should their numbers be increased. Here's the problem. A lone masked hero can be an imposing sight in fiction. However, several masked people automatically become faceless goons. It's a bizarre logic that writers and audiences still regularly accept, just as the New Age pseudoscience of homeopathy puts it that the greater water dilution of a product, the stronger its properties. Martial arts movies has it that the more ninjas are present, the greater their ineptitude. This cliché is particularly irritating when it's established just how deadly and elite ninjas are supposed to be in a story. We often get displays of their acrobatic prowess and their extreme discipline. Sometimes they're part of a sacred order that has stringent entry requirements where only the strongest will be permitted access to the training. And even more confounding is the plot point that our incredibly skilled martial arts hero is a former member. With points like this established, all this army's menace is diminished when an entire horde is dispatched with ease by outnumbered protagonists. To make matters worse, many films and TV series even have individuals who aren't supposed to be particularly talented fighters having little trouble taking down multiple ninja henchmen. The message is quite clear. Fear the lone ninja bodyguard, not the Legion. a bizarre triumph for minimalistic art, where less really is more. With this in mind, let's move back to my interview with Jan Drachman and his second martial arts pet peeve. Multiple Motivations by Jan Drachman.
Multiple opponents, then, in films. I mean, obviously, this is a subject touched upon before. I'm sure it's a bugbear that a lot of people would talk about. But you're not only got a bugbear with it, you've not only got a problem with it, you've also got ideas on how you can improve it.
Yeah, because you always hate when multiple opponents. I know when you're doing your talks, you talk about bystander effects and stuff like that, when people freeze and don't do anything. But it's not like that. They're not frozen. They're not doing some kind of fight shuffle where they're more or less moving in the place and waiting for their turn to fight to attack.
Yeah.
Because they're attacking a little later when it's their turn. So it's not they're not frozen. They're just shuffling in the place and waiting.
The funny thing is, Jan, with that has remained a consistent trope in martial arts movies and movies with martial arts featuring in them. Earlier on in this pod, I talk about how the definition of a martial arts movie is quite hard to do. What is a martial arts movie? What's not? And certainly now, and has it ever been? But in terms of that trope, when you see one person fighting multiple opponents, that we're still stuck in that lining up, aren't we? And I'd say 80% at least of fight scenes where you've got multiple opponents, they're still lining up waiting to do that. The thing is that it's funny how that's still accepted now, because I've read contemporary criticisms of fight scenes back in the 70s where people who weren't martial artists but were watching these movies and they were taking the mickey out of them back then. So that, you know, the general audience can see that it's not realistic and their suspension of disbelief gets hampered by that kind of thing. And it's still happening. You know, you'll watch an episode of one of the DC superheroes TV shows and nearly all their fight scenes, when it's multiple, there are people waiting their turn and they're fighting one on one. Yeah, so... Yeah.
Sometimes they use it as a part of the movie, to just like in Kill Bill 2, one where Beatrice Kiddo is fighting the Crazy 88, where there are a lot of fighting. And you know they're just where it's more or less a theater where you're playing a lot because it looks very, very nice. But when you know about the fight, you won't wait. I will try to get in by punching with some of the other guys, so I'm sure I'll win. But as we talked about how to solve the problem, because the hero is going to fight several opponents. Otherwise, the fight is a little boring sometimes. If you get a one kill punch in and then fight is over in 2 seconds, then what should the audience watch? So,
what's the drama?
What's the drama? So, when you see the good example is the hallway fight scene from Daredevil, where Daredevil is coming in. It's an awesome. I think many people have watched it, and the way they solve it, they all the multiple opponents, they're in different rooms. There's one guy in the corridor, and then the other guys are in different rooms that are adjacent to the corridor. So he fights his way in, and they come out of the rooms, and they obstruct each other, so they can't start fighting because the other guy is obstructing the hallway. And it's a fantastic fight scene because it's a multiple opponent, but there's not much room.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is Daredevil season one. The corridor sequences, it's shot beautifully. I mean, it's often given as an example of really, really good cinematography. Yeah. And as you say, it's a plot device. The plot device that's in there allows Daredevil to be able to fight one opponent at a time, even though there's multiples coming, because it's a corridor, because they're coming out of the doors, because their opponents are obstructing each other. And that's what makes it a lot more believable. Obviously, virtually all fight scenes that we see, they're not real, but it's all about how you suspend our disbelief. And in that one, we can buy into that. And it looks great and very refreshing change. And it's a shame that still now, TV shows, movies, they're not taking a leaf out of that book and thinking, okay, we've got a multiple opponent scene. How are we going to do this and make it plausible? And funny enough, as I said to you before, I spoke to John Anderson, Dorman, who mentored Jeff Thompson. I mean, Watch My Back, and some of Jeff's characters are based on, I know. And when I did my brief training with him, and we did this video training session with him when he was teaching me, and when I was interviewing him for a magazine, a martial arts magazine, he explained to me a similar situation where they organized so that when a crowd of people had broken into the nightclub, they went down a corridor to bottleneck them so that they could deal with them in that way. So there's reality there. I mean, and again, and you see this in battles, in historical battles, where one army strategically sets it up so that the other army can't all come in one go, like over a bridge, for example. You set the battle ahead of a bridge. I think that's the Battle of Stirling, isn't there? The one with William Wallace. Yeah. They used the bridge. So it's got, you know, it's got basis in reality and it's plausible. We can accept it. We can accept now why, in a multiple opponent situation, why that one or two or three heroes are facing overwhelming odds and how they can deal with them because they're using the benefit of props, plot devices as well.
Yeah, so they can either tactically position themselves within the environment.
Yes.
So they can line the opponents up so they get one at a time or few at a time. Or they build the environment in this movie set that so it's like a bridge or a corridor or small room or some kind of maze or something when they're fighting in. Then you can solve it. And the other opportunity is that the hero is escaping. He just can run away. And then if he runs faster than the other guys, he can take them one at a time.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And you should definitely think about when you're doing a multiple opponent fight scene, you should do it more realistic. So, but maybe not, maybe it's only people like us that are annoyed by it because
As I said, I do think that the general audience is one of the tropes and cliches that a lot of the lay audience critics are often take the mickey out of a martial arts movie. Oh, it's one of those films where the group of people line up and fight one another. I think somehow they're getting away with it, obviously, because it's still popular. It still remains this trope, doesn't it? You know, it still remains this cliche that's in there. So it might be us, but I do think other people do see it as well. And as I said, and I think, you know, movie critics. And one of the things I've really tried to do at the beginning of this particular show is to start think that martial arts movies often get a bad reputation. And a lot of the time it's deserved because there's a lot of bad martial arts movies out there, but there's a lot of bad movies full stop. And there's different categories. There's some films that are so bad they're good, you know, we enjoy them. Yeah. There are other films that artistically they're beautiful, they're brilliant, but in terms of an overall film, they're not very good. You know, you take a movie like Cradle to the Grave. So for me, that was a film I was looking forward to for so long, and it was such a massive disappointment. I really rated Mark Dacascos. Surprised he hasn't become the massive star that he deserved to be because he could both act really well and also was a really good on-screen performer. But he, unfortunately, I think he ends up with a lot of bad projects. So I thought he had everything. And there he was going up against Jet Li in the end fight scene. They're both strong backgrounds in wushu performance and that was going to be the fight scene. And what they ended up doing is breaking it up into three different fight scenes with the two other protagonists who, awful fight choreography, you really couldn't care less what was going on, and they should have just left it to building up to this particular scene. But, and again, this is the meddling that you often get with like production, I'm sure, or behind the scenes going, oh no, we have to, these actors, they've got to be promoted, they've got to be really up there, you know, this is, you know, rather than saying, no, come on, this is what's going to save the movie, this is what's going to make the movie really, really good. I mean, a bit like, I suppose, Star Wars The Phantom Menace. For all that movie's massive criticism, the standout moment for many people there is Ray Park playing Darth Maul going up against Liam Neeson and Ewan McGregor playing Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan respectively. And that's really the standout moment of that particular movie. You've got those elements that really stand out in the film. But again, a lot of the time that you find with martial arts movies, my point being is that they get a bad reputation, yet there are some really good ones out there that unfortunately, because they're under the martial arts banner, they don't get the attention that they might deserve because of this kind of thing. And again, it's often, I think, trying to get rid of some of these tropes, such as bad sound design, like you're talking about there, the multiple opponent cliche, which, as you say, in Kill Bill, we give it a pass in Kill Bill because it's supposed to be, as you described it before, it's a pastiche, isn't it? It's supposed to be trying to emulate that sort of thing of the era. And that's the reason why the blood is hyper unrealistic, because it's using the effects of them. And that's the whole point of it. That's what sort of makes it borderline, you know, art house. You know, some people even regard the Kill Bill films to be something of an art house movie, more so than a martial arts kung fu movie. You know, it superficially resembles that, but it's actually an art house movie because of those sort of factors. We give them a pass on that, but for the most part, martial arts movies, there are certain things you just feel that they could do that would then help improve their reputation. And so therefore, the better ones, the ones that don't deserve to be chucked in that mix, might get a little bit more attention.
Yeah, but I think when you've seen the hero, he's the hero. She's the hero, and she's doing a lot of right stuff and everything. But why are they positioning themselves in the middle and get surrounded by a lot of enemies? That's stupid.
Yeah, no,
exactly. You have to go to the side or corner of them, or you should never position yourself in the middle. This is
no.
So it's obvious. So you could just fight your way out in the weakest place or something and line the other ones up, and you should just wait and get surrounded. Yeah. It's stupid. So
yeah,
you could even have a good multi-component fight scene if the hero was moving to some of the other places, but they're just standing still and waiting.
Yeah, it really is a lining up process, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's often the dynamic. It is the lining up. That's exactly what's happened. They just put the focus on them in one place, and then everyone else, coming in. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, of course, there's many other things we could talk about, but you have touched about many of them already in your other parts of this.
I've got to save some stuff for you, Jan, for next time as well.
Yeah, that's cool.
Thank you very much for being on the show. It's a real honour to have you on board. And thank you for your insight into this particular part. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Jamie.
Jan Drachmann, known to us as Dragon Man, is the supreme commander of the Wombats, Denmark's elite karateka. Jan is a great guy who's done some truly remarkable things with Hinnerup Karate and progressive traditional martial arts in Denmark. Through Jan, I have met remarkable martial artists such as fellow karate teacher Flemming Anderson and taekwondo teacher Michael Odesheed. Jan is always keen to move forward and is the very definition of a can-do person who brings people together in the pursuit of improvement. Thank you so much, Jan, for agreeing to be on this show. The Complete Fighter by Matt State.
Hi, Jamie. Matt State here. As a long-time watcher of martial arts movies and a great big fan, there are certain elements towards those that are really sort of irritating and I could really live without. And one of those that springs to mind is when you have a martial arts instructor who's the hero of a movie, it turns out that they can make a bomb, they can drive a bike, they can steer a powerboat, they can do all of these crazy things. Now, you know, I've been training for a very long time and never once did I ever go to a martial arts class where we learned how to make a bomb or jet ski, which is a shame because I'd love to know how to do both.
If you've been listening to my previous Martial Movie Massacre shows this year, then you will note that I lay a lot of the blame for cliches at the door of our beloved James Bond franchise, both in Fleming's original novels and in the subsequent feature films and video games. In this instance, Bond gets a huge pass, and it is his imitators that are to blame. His martial arts abilities are incidental, and we expect him to have a wide knowledge of other skills in order to be an effective killer spy. However, what I think has happened through the action movie and fiction genre is that writers have seen martial arts as a shortcut for being James Bond. One of the best examples that comes to mind is 1991's The Perfect Weapon. This fun guilty pleasure appears to have been both a vehicle for actor martial artist Jeff Speakman and an advert for American Kenpo Karate. Its simplistic story concerns a wayward youth who is taught Kenpo to control his anger, becomes estranged from his family, and then works as a construction working drifter. He then returns to his hometown to see his old mentor only to become embroiled in a one-man war against the Korean Mafia. Throughout the movie, we see Speakman's character perform a range of specialist infiltration skills that I'm pretty sure are not in Ed Parker's extensive syllabus. Matt State is the best-selling author of four books. I've only just recently finished reading his excellent online martial arts Evolution or Extinction, which he wrote with the hugely talented and always insightful Kai Morgan. As a fellow promoter of children's self-protection, I applaud Matt's book 20 Ways to Keep Your Child Safe. He has also written about his career in the security industry, Modern Samurai, and a martial arts autobiography, My Journey to the Mountain, The Road to Black Belt. Matt is the founder and owner of the Modern Samurai Martial Arts Academy. His interview with me for Martial Arts Great Britain can be found on the Club Chimera Martial Arts playlist on my channel and on Matt's own Modern Samurai Online channel. Epilogue. Somewhere in the world right now, a child has picked up a stick and slashed it through the air. For a moment, the stick has become a weapon against an imaginary enemy. This is the child's moments of valour and empowerment. Now they are the hero of their story, fighting against injustice and evil. Maybe the stick is now a sword, a lightsaber, or some other fantastical blade. Perhaps the stick is just a stick, and rather it is the child that has become the skilled combatant, a master of themselves and their destiny. Another child punches and kicks the air, visualizing these strikes creating a tremendous impact against their phantom opponent. Others engage in choreographed grappling matches made up on the spot. Sometimes these pretend fights go a stage too far, and the players are quickly reminded about the boundaries between fantasy and reality. Some of these children will attempt to seek out such reality so that they can protect themselves, protect others, or just be able to perform the moves for real. Even fewer of these children will stick with whatever local martial arts school they have found and become martial artists. Behind the movements, behind the improvised dances, behind the need to express their imaginations, there is a story. That story is told through moving images on a screen and on rare occasions through the pages of novels or comics. They know it is part of a far larger tale, but the narrative that has excited their imaginations concerns the conflict. The tropes of these fictional duels and battles quickly becomes devices to frame their games. Often there is dramatic dialogue declaring this to be the final fight between protagonist and antagonist. To the very young, the constant replaying of the same tropes and cliches will be enough. However, others will eventually be wearied as they look to pursue a new fantasy reenactment, or even play an organised game. The filmic world of the martial arts has a lot to offer if only we demand more, and the best films get the credit they deserve. If you look deep enough, you will see a rich legacy that stretches back to the earliest days of fiction and dramatisation. The thrill of conflict, whether you interpret it as a form of catharsis, or a philosophical struggle, or pure indulgent adrenal rush sent by a sympathetic nervous system, has always entertained audiences. Some stories have stood out by the way they encourage their audiences to ask questions regarding why people fight, why certain people fight better than others, and what the fight does to individuals. There are certain stage duels that stand out as pure art in the story they tell. Warriors, through their on-stage fighting style, through the way they combine their acting ability with the way their fight scene is paced and arranged, can reveal as much about their characters as any amount of dialogue. We can see their valour, their corruption, their courage, their cowardice, their resilience, their ambition, their naivety, their resourcefulness, their arrogance, and their relationship with others. Key plot points are revealed and hidden strengths are found. All of this might be expressed through the aerial battles of Hero, the paced-out brilliance of the final duel in The Empire Strikes Back, the righteous force of 14 Amazons, the self-referential, artistic, unrestrained indulgence of Kill Bill, or through the simple cutting arc traced by a child's hand holding a stick. I would like to thank all my wonderful contributors for this show and the previous ones this year. Please go through the show notes for links of their respective work. You will not be disappointed. Don't miss out on any of the webinars I'm currently running on a regular basis. Wonderful clubs such as Keiru Practical Karate, Athena Karate, Forest School of Karate, Hinnerup Karate and Ryukin Shorinru have been hosting me every month. Often these webinars are open to all and are inexpensive. I've been covering such topics as my children's self-protection program, my adult self-protection program, martial arts cross-training and combat conditioning. Several people have taken the opportunity to book me for live streaming one-to-one classes via Skype and Zoom. If you have internet, I can teach you, no matter where you are in the world. Supporters of this show, I need your five-star reviews, please. iTunes is the primary place to go to, but obviously check out any of your podcasting platforms, and if you can put a review up there, it'll be gratefully received. Thank you very much. If you have any comments, questions and feedback, please send them to me via email off the clubchimera.com website, or why not support Club Chimera Martial Arts further by joining in the discussions on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn or YouTube. I'd love to hear from you. This episode brings us to the end of the Martial Movie Massacre for this year. We will move on to other subjects with our next show. This will include bonus episode, tons of new material, and our annual tradition, the Halloween episode. I look forward to presenting it to you soon. For now, thanks for listening.